UWA 517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind of it?
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, Senator.
Ares 31, me neither.
There are 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was anybody above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There are 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Pump this. A UFO.
Yeah. It's Merger 1095. Yeah, something just passed over us. Like us. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. See, I passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Did we just call about the UFOs we thought?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there. Same airplanes.
At a dispatch.
Okay.
Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls?
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
Alright, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Hello everyone, welcome to the show wherever you are listening tonight. We have a great one tonight to mark our 20th episode. We have Patrick from the East Coast coming on the moment to talk about his encounters on his travels to Montana. And if you're interested in our show's merchandise, you can find the link in the description. All kinds of cool stuff there. And if you're after a bumper sticker to let the car behind you know what great taste you have in a podcast, shoot me an email and I will get one out to you. Right, let's get on with the show. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you, Nick.
You come to us all the way from New Jersey.
That's correct.
And you have a lot to tell us tonight.
I do. These life-changing events have been on deck for many years, pretty much just waiting for me to step into the batter's box. And, you know, it's been a long time coming. From 2010, however, like I was telling you before, I went down the rabbit hole pretty far. And, you know, I was researching as much as I could, contacting as many people as I could, really Freedom of Information Act, as many times as I could to get my information. And to the point where, you know, I came home one day and there were 2 unmarked cars outside my house. Very strange. No plates on the cars. Even the windshields were tinted. And this was for 2 days. So it pretty much made me pump my brakes on the whole subject of that we're interested in. And it wasn't until a few years later that an incident happened to a friend of mine and myself that pretty much refueled the fire to get me back into this. So I've had a lot to say for a long time, and I'm glad I'll be able to do it on your show first.
I really appreciate you coming on. Okay, if you want to start in December 1996.
You got it. Well, this is where it all starts. December 1996, I have to give you a little bit of the backstory to add to the context of how huge this was. Like many kids, December of 96 was when I was having a little too much fun at college, and the baseball scholarship that I worked so hard to achieve was taken away from me. Next thing I know, I'm back in my old house at my parents' in my bedroom, wallowing, sulking, not knowing what to do. And there was a map on my wall, and on that map was one thumbtack. And that thumbtack was stuck into the state that I never knew or heard anybody coming from, and that was the state of Montana. Now, before I go any further, this is knowledge that I did not even know at the time, but Montana at that point in the mid-90s was very much the wild, wild west. It was filled with eccentric people who wanted to disappear from society and basically not be seen again. When I first got out there, just for a quick story here, when I went in there, the speed limit in Montana just said reasonable and prudent. There was no speed limit. So when I got pulled over by a cop doing 102 miles an hour, he basically said, son, just make sure you have better tires next time you want to go that fast. So where this happened was a spot in the country that I had no idea was a mecca for, you know, sightings in the sky, sightings in the big sky. Montana is referred to as big sky country. And there is no place in the lower 48 that you could possibly get a vista like this. So when you lay back in the grass or you happen to look up on a dark, clear night, if you really concentrate, you're bound to see something. So when I left, what happened was I basically took off in the middle of the night. I told my parents, this is when I was 20 years old. I told my parents nothing. Got in my car early in the morning, went to a bank, slept in the parking lot, waited to withdraw my $735. And then from there, I basically took off to Montana without telling anybody. And the drive out there was very, very lonesome, very thought-provoking, very unnerving, knowing that I was going somewhere that by the time I got there, I would be dead broke. It would be the middle of winter, and I would be in way over my head, not knowing what was going to come next. However, just to digress for a second, I did convince a friend of mine to come join me out there. And what happened was he and I actually sat in an apartment, a basement apartment in Bozeman, Montana for an entire month with nothing to do, watching the snow fall, having no job, just waiting for the rug to be pulled out from under us for us to have to go back to New Jersey with our tail between our legs. However, we knew nobody, and there was a gentleman, and I use that word loosely because this guy was pretty eccentric himself, who saw that the two 20-year-old kids, myself and my friend, were basically had nothing going. And this man introduced himself into our life through a real estate investment. He wanted to see if myself and my friend wanted to buy 2.5 acres of land next to Glacier National Park, which is one of the most extraordinary national parks in the country. Now, he wanted to sell us the land for about $3,000. Before I go any further, what this man didn't tell us was that he had ulterior motives. He wanted us to secretly join his commune, and he was going to do everything that he possibly could to lure us up there and basically make us get stuck there. We weren't going to be able to get out, and hopefully by that point, we would just succumb to the fact that we would be living commune life with people in the deep woods of Montana. And we would have no way out, and that was it. So one night, he coerced us, basically, because we had nothing else to do. We were running out of entertainment. Now, this man, he was about 29 years old, and you'd probably have to picture him. He was, I don't know if you've ever heard of the show Breaking Bad or anything, but Walter White in the show deals with a topic that he produces. Well, this individual, I think, was on a little too much of this stuff. But we were 20 years old at the time. And we were looking for any kind of excitement, any way to get out of this apartment. So we decided to go up there with him. So for 9 hours, we got in my horrible car and drove from southern Montana to the Canadian border. Now, that's basically the distance from New York City to Cleveland. And it took us forever to get there. Now, to cut to the chase, we were driving down a road through the absolute barren wilderness near where we were finally about to get to. And this individual, without me even realizing it, jumped up between my seats, grabbed the steering wheel, and actually threw my car off the road. Basically, we weren't going anywhere from there unless we were getting towed or winched out. So we were stuck. Now, this was about 3 o'clock in the morning. From there, we were supposed to walk to this gentleman's, and as I said, I use that term loosely, this man's cabin. This man's cabin was way out in the woods. He barely even knew how to get there in the summertime. So now there was feet and feet of snow. He was asking us to follow him through the dense Montana wilderness where he was telling us, look, Pat, Kenzie, this was my friend's name is Kenzie. We're going to be walking through mountain lion loops. Mountain lions only hunt in the same 2 mile circle. We're bound to run into one. We're going to be walking for hours post-holing through snow before we hopefully get to my cabin. Now, when we began walking, this was late December of 1996 in a Montana winter, which is about as cold as you could possibly get in the lower 48 states. We were bundled to the hills. We had coats. We had our backpacks. This man was dressed in basically a t-shirt because he was being fueled by something that didn't really allow him to feel cold. So we followed him. We started following him down a road until finally the road ended, and it was basically now time to just walk through Montana wilderness in the middle of the night, in the middle of the winter. So we began to follow him, post-holing through snow, and that's where the journey really began. The walk through the wilderness started, and the clear sky of the Big Sky of Montana was in full grandeur at that point. When you look up and see a clear black sky in Montana at night, there's nothing like it, maybe except in Alaska. So that's what we did. We began walking and following him. Now, what I have to say is that aside from the land deal that this man wanted to make us, he had some very wild theories that we pretty much just put aside. He believed that December 31st, 1999 was the end of it all. We didn't know it was called Y2K yet. Nobody did. Nobody termed it that yet. But that's all he talked about. And he talked in this real hardcore Southern drawl, because I'm guessing he was from probably around Texas or somewhere around there, and that's where he came from. He was convinced that AIDS was mainlined into society by the American government. This was stuff that he just rattled off at whim as we just walked. He talked to us about this ad nauseum as we drove up for 9 hours, to the point where basically all we wanted to do was try to make the land transaction, grab the 2.5 acres of land off of him, and never see him again. This man was out of his mind. So we're walking, and now it's starting to become late. It's very late. It's only a few hours before dawn. My friend and I are so cold. The snow is so deep that we are just basically discarding everything we own. The backpack is gone. We can't carry it anymore. Jackets are gone because it's just getting too cumbersome to walk, as this man is just leading the way step by step, just post-holing through the snow. Now, when we were in the middle of it all and we could barely walk another step, we were furious. My friend and I, Kenzie, we were furious and wanted nothing more to do with this guy. However, we'd gone too far. My car was stuck, so there was no way of getting it out short of a helicopter or somebody with a winch, and we knew nobody there. And he basically told us the only way to get my car out and go back home was to follow him and do what he says. So from there, we just kept going step by step, as the cold and the only thing that actually made this enjoyable was looking up every once in a while and seeing the full moon illuminating all of the Rocky Mountain peaks under the stars that were just more heavenly than you can ever imagine. It was an unbelievable sight. And anybody who appreciates nature, sometimes you got to go through some pain to see the best spots in the world. So finally, he told us basically he doesn't know where his cabin is. We're probably not going to get there. We might be walking in the wrong direction. And my friend and I lose it. And he sees us losing it, and he basically he doesn't care. He's firing off his revolver. He's got a gun on him that he's just shooting wildly every once in a while, loading with bullets. Like I said, it was Montana in the mid-90s when there was no reins on the law. So we'd lost it. And this is where it comes to the pass where he goes, "Well, boys," he goes, "I know you don't believe me that AIDS was mainlined into society by the American government. I know you don't believe me that Y2K, that wasn't Y2K, December 31st, 1999, is going to be the end of the world. I know you don't believe in any of that." And we're like, "Yeah," his name was Todd. And we said, "Todd, just get us to a cabin, get us to a fire, get us somewhere where we know we're not going to die," because we'd lost it. He goes, "I'm not moving another step until you tell me what that is." And he points up to the sky. And reluctantly, we both look up, and there it was. It was the most incredible sight I can honestly say I've ever seen. It was giant. And I'm saying it was giant because if you were to look at the sky, it was actually probably the size of a basketball in front of your face. That's how big the circular object was. It was green on the bottom and white on top with a red strobe going across it. When we first looked up, it was stationary. It wasn't doing anything except pulsating. And my friend and I were so mesmerized, so petrified, so in awe that we basically fell back into the snow and were laying there with tears coming down the sides of our face because we couldn't believe what we saw, until a few seconds later when this thing started dancing all over the sky. It started darting from side to side all over the horizon. But the thing that really gave it context and gave it depth was if you could picture Rocky Mountains, the Rocky Mountains, or the Alps, or any kind of jagged peaks that have snow-capped peaks or mountains sitting under an illuminated sky from a full moon with stars all over the place with a pitch black background. this thing started just dancing over the Rocky Mountain peaks, basically bouncing from one peak to the other before just going back up into the sky and staying stationary. We laid there. This guy, Todd, had seen it so many times. It was just a bore to him. And he said to us, he always called us boys. He's like, boys, he's like, you think that's effed up? He's like, there's usually like four or five of them all together flying around in formation. That's why my wife and my daughter won't come back here anymore. We didn't know what to say. We were so upset. I was upset. I didn't even know what to do. It just threw everything out the window. All rules of life, all thoughts of survival, all thoughts of where are we going from here. I didn't even know what to do. My friend, who actually is gets a little more panic stricken quicker than I do, was really a mess from this. So from there, we basically, by dawn, we did end up finding his cabin. Now, we stayed there for a couple days because we were forced to. And this is where it gets really, really wild, because he wanted us to join his commune. What we didn't know is that he was only a plebe, like a serf, like just a minor cog in the wheel of this commune. He was nothing. And what we also didn't know is that the people of this commune hated him. They hated him so bad because basically he'd left like a year before, never told anybody, boarded up his cabin, and that was it. And he knew that when he came back, there would be retribution. The people of this commune were probably going to come down hard on him. But we didn't know that. And we didn't know that by following him, we would just be in the crosshairs of these people as well. So there was a leader of this commune, and he was a fascinating man. He's probably long gone now. But as I said prior, when you wanted to disappear into society, you went to places like Montana. Now, this gentleman, who apparently, we'll call him Cajun, because he had a name kind of similar to that, and his life was quite spicy, and so was his personality. However, he was about to introduce us to his leader of the commune the next day. And the way he did this was quite extraordinary, because by the time it got to be dawn, the Montana Valley next to Glacier National Park, there's no neighbors. The nearest person was miles and miles away through the wilderness, through the woods. And the way he signaled these people was my friend and I finally fell asleep when we reached this cabin. What was in the cabin when we got there? His door was broken down. And these are details that are they were very scarring at the time. But when we got there and we finally reached this dilapidated cabin, this cabin he made was like something that a 5-year-old in like a woodworking class probably could have made. It was made out of like plywood, and, you know, there was barely a roof, a cockeyed window. However, there was a stove, and we did end up getting into the cabin near the stove. But what we didn't realize is that, and he didn't realize, is that through the time that he was gone, people in the valley had come to just pretty much vandalize his cabin because they hated him. And he kind of let us know subtly that he wasn't in the good graces of the people in the valley. And when we got there, apparently, from what I gathered and from what he said, the door of the cabin was gone. I'm guessing probably in the summertime, somebody actually lured a game into the cabin with apples or God knows what, something to get maybe what turned out to be an elk, to just basically walk up two steps and into a cabin and, you know, have some apples or some food. And when we got there and he illuminated the inside of the cabin with his lighter, all over the place was just animal remains, animal guts. There was blood spackled to the walls, and there was this dead elk. If it wasn't an elk, it was probably like a mule deer or something. And we were horrified. My friend and I were now just, you know, we had no food. We hadn't slept. We were screwed. And now we realized we walked into like, you know, a straight up murder scene. And he was, you could tell he was a little off. This threw him off. However, we crawled upstairs. He had a little second floor, and we slept next to the stove for maybe, I would say, an hour before we woke up to a gunshot. And the gunshot was out of this cockeyed window that he somehow put into this cabin. If you could picture this cabin, it was atrocious. I mean, literally any woodworker would have been just sick over how this man put together four walls and a roof. But what this Todd did, he shot an elk outside the window as we were sleeping. The gunshot actually had my friend so freaked out and flinched us awake that my friend burned himself on the stove. But what he did is Todd shot an elk outside the window, and we went outside, and he basically dumped fuel, like petrol, on the elk, and lit it ablaze. And now the pitch black Montana sky at night had now turned crystal clear blue sky in the daytime. And the black smoke, if you've ever seen Dances with Wolves, and, you know, Kevin Costner pretty much signals to everybody in the area that, hey, here I am. It went up, and he basically realized that he meant to do it, but I don't think he realized how hard it was going to come down. Now, I'm going to fast forward a little bit because a lot of stuff happened between this point and when we met Cajun, the leader of the commune. And Cajun had a story all of his own. I don't know if I just said this before, but Cajun was a, as Todd said it, he was a bank robber in the 70s, you know, just robbed farm banks in like Wyoming and you know, Montana, banks that nobody had. There was no security. There was no nothing. This is where farmers and, you know, agrarian people would just go dump their, you know, their savings and then withdraw. These banks were just, you know, anybody could probably rob them. And this guy did. Until the point where he ended up, I guess, on one of the FBI list, and he just retreated into the backwoods of Montana, and with his charisma and with his personality, started to gather people who were very weak-minded, and he started this commune. And this guy Todd, who lured us up there, was part of this. So the next day, we end up through a whole story in itself. We end up meeting Cajun. Now Cajun was about 60 years old, I would say. He was former special forces. He was still at 60 years old, a very bruiserish man. He was built, and he had a beautiful salt and pepper flat top. You know, the guy really looked like something straight out of a movie, and he was an intimidating man to look at. But what was even stranger was that he ended up marrying a girl who was about 24 years old at the time, and in backwoods standards, in a place where nobody comes out of the woods, this girl was very striking. And, you know, as I later found out, it was a daughter of one of the members of the commune that pretty much was almost born and raised to be this guy's wife, because the commune had been up and running for some years now. So we end up meeting Cajun, and this is where my sighting ties into a story that I don't even know what to think, because this guy Cajun, as we met him, and I'm fast forwarding through all the details, finally, after threatening Todd's life and basically saying, Todd, I don't even want to see you here, Cajun really took a shine to my friend and myself, because basically everybody that Cajun dealt with back in the backcountry of Montana wasn't educated. We had personalities. We were educated. We came from society. We got to give them a little information on what was going on in the outside world. These people had no phones. They didn't even know what was going on. So this guy Cajun, as we were prepared for, we were about to meet one of the scariest people we would ever encounter. And for the first hour of being around him, I was scared to death, absolutely scared to death. But as we got the courage to talk to him and everything, he really started to like us. And he began taking us around the valley and showing us different spots. Just to, you know, as a side note here, something very interesting was back in the mid-90s, you know, when Nazi Germany became disbanded and World War II was over, a lot of the old Nazis either went to South America, you know, Paraguay, Argentina. Some of them went to Montana. And the man Cajun took us to meet an ex-Nazi war criminal who had some broken English, and I know had an incredible story to tell himself, but it was incredible to be in the presence of somebody with so much history in him and who was still very, very evil. And you could tell this. But anyway, Cajun, getting back to the topic at hand, said, look, Todd explained to me what you guys saw last night. And we were so like caught up in the moment that had escaped us. We didn't even remember that. And it came right back to us, and we started asking him, you know, what was that? What is this? Now these people, they would not even entertain the thought of life elsewhere. That was the farthest thing from their mind. If an alien actually did hypothetically show up in front of them, they would still think it was the government. They thought this was the U.S. government at work through and through. They all thought this, except Cajun. He really entertained the thought of what it could possibly be. He wouldn't make those details available about what he thought, but I could tell there were some inklings that, he thought this might be from elsewhere. And as I will say, I will never say this is where it's from, this is what it is. I just say what I saw. So he begins to tell us a story and begins to show us some kind of proof of what happened to him. He lifted up his shirt, and as built as the man was, he was beginning to show signs of some pretty aggressive cancer. And, it was very almost foul to look at because it was starting to, grow externally on his skin and it was starting to bulge out. And, we didn't want to ask about it. However, it kind of came to the crux of the story where it was like, how did this happen to him? And he begins to tell us a story about basically he was hunting near Todd's cabin. Now, he didn't say that it was him who shot the elk in Todd's cabin and left it there and basically defaced Todd's cabin as a sign of, look, we hate Todd. If he comes back, this is what he wants to let him know what we think of him by doing this. But as he said, he used to hunt around Todd's cabin. And when him and another gentleman were hunting together, they saw one of these craft. It wasn't the exact craft that I saw because my friend and I saw, because that one was enormous. This was a smaller craft of more of a disc shaped, he said, more metallic, more mechanical looking, and it actually made noise. And his friend and himself, as he describes it, his friend took a shot at the thing. And it was basically hovering, I don't know, maybe as he said, maybe like 100 feet, like above Todd's cabin, but like a little bit askew. And he said that his friend took a shot at this thing and hit it. And the thing actually like buckled a little bit. When he did this, when his friend, Cajun's friend, did this, they panicked immediately. They realized that they probably made a mistake and then ran straight for the tree line to just take some cover, get some camouflage, be unseen, because they were standing basically out in a huge meadow. And he said that as he did this, the craft began to just hover over the trees, basically almost in like a surveillance mode, just kind of like looking at them, looking to find them. And they said that they were just at the bottom of the tree, just huddled, trying not to make any noise, not to make, not to be seen. And what happened was, as he says it, this craft eventually was just above him, above the trees. And they could tell that he kept saying it was making a mechanical noise and that it was hovering there and that they'd been spotted. And what came down to it, and as he said how he got these tumors or whatever you would like to call them, he said that this thing opened up something on the bottom of the craft and just this very viscous red material just dumped out all down the trees onto the snow. It was just like a huge puddle just left the craft and hit the ground. And they happened to be right under it. And he was hit with all this stuff, this very gelatinous material, as he said. He took the brunt of it, where a lot of it hit him. The other gentleman who I did meet had his whole hand, the other guy, we'll call him Pete. Pete's hand was just red. It was you could tell it didn't look tumorish. It didn't look as bad as Cajun's back did, but he was probably in for not a good future when it came to being healthy. So as Cajun is describing this and saying everything about what he believes this craft was and where it came from and how long apparently they've been seeing these things since the day that they've all entered the woods. This was a norm. They didn't see it every night, they didn't see it every week, but they saw it enough. Not just that craft, as Todd said before, there was, and I asked Cajun this, I asked, so Todd said there was, craft flying around in formation, maybe four or five. And he said, oh yeah. He's like, but as he said, he really kept going back to the government side of it. And, you know, he would never really let it fully go that this might have been something from elsewhere. Now, the metallic craft, as you know, I deduced, it's a metallic craft making noise. This could very well be something, you know, from a black project, something from, you know, a military grade vehicle, you know, just like how the TR-3B is out there right now. I don't mean to jump topics or whatever, but this very well could have been man-made, the craft that actually dumped something on him. However, what my friend and I saw the night before, there was no way that this thing was, you know, part of a secret black operation by any government of this planet.
Introducing the High Strangeness Coffee Blend by Redacted Coffee Company, a medium roast of the Brazilian kind. This medium roast offers flavors of chocolate and vanilla combined with a distinct fruity taste and a unique sweet floral aroma. The experience of High Strangeness doesn't end there, with a sweet butter aftertaste that doesn't fade as your coffee cools. This coffee regains its flavors all the way through your cup, ensuring it truly is good to the last drop. The veteran-funded, employee-owned Redacted Coffee Company and UFO Chronicles podcast have partnered together to bring you the best coffee on and off the planet. Get 20% off your first order now at redactedcoffee.com/UFO. That's redactedcoffee.com/UFO. Or follow the link below in this episode's description or click on the banner of my website. This podcast is fueled by coffee oozing high strangeness. So what are you waiting for? Wake up to the strange.
So I will tell this part of the story just because it's actually quite interesting. We wanted to get out of there. Now I'm cutting to the chase because, you know, a lot of the rest of the story has nothing to do with this. However, we did end up getting my car pulled out of the snow 2 days later. And this was just around the time where Cajun was, he took such a shine to us that he wanted my friend and I to stay. He wanted us to stay and basically take over his operation that he'd been running because he knew his time was almost up. He had a very nice wife who turned out, I haven't even gotten into her. She was a wonderful person. But he basically wanted one of us to knock up his wife and stay there. And he said that to us. Can you run our operation? You know, the people that I have under me right now, none of them are anywhere near as educated. They have no business savvy. You know, even and the only thing that dissuaded us, no, I won't say the only thing that dissuaded us, the whole thing dissuaded us. But what really got us to get out of there was that it was such an illegal operation. It was a very scary thing. You'd just be battling the law from the backwoods of Montana your entire life. It was a joy actually knowing the guy because it was very exciting. It's one of those things where adventure is never fun when it's happening. Never. If you're on a true adventure, it's never fun when it's happening. It's only when you get to come back, sit in a chair and reminisce about everything that you're like, wow, what did we just go through? And the element of danger that we felt through that entire time with this man, with Todd especially, was really something else. And, you know, these people had good hearts. They really did. They were crazy, but you could not take away what they saw in the sky on a regular basis because we saw it. And now I will end that there, but that was 1996, and I left Montana basically the same way that I went out there. I left in a very, let's just say, a very grand way. I ended up riding my bicycle. I ended up pedaling a bicycle from Montana back to New Jersey in 1998.
Yellow and blue. are the colors, oh, that I bleed. I bleed for you. Juice box empties up above. I'm so thirsty, I'm in love. It's cold outside but warm in here. I broke down, stuck in here. Life, oh, life makes no sense. I wrote 1,000 letters I never sent. Sunshine shining from the sky, off the water and in my eye. Trees are blowing in the wind, they never break. They only bend. Woman, oh, woman, stronger than man. It's a present I'd never break from. And if I can. I would go down the Rio Grande, Mexico. Rattle my cage and I load my gun. I fight the war just for fun. Life, oh, life makes no sense. I wrote 1,000 letters I never sent. Church bell rings, oh, 29 times for a high sea shipwreck they will never find. Dropped dead twice just a year ago, then I came back alive, walking in from love snow. Woman, oh, woman, stronger than man. It's a present I'd never break from. If I can. Prayer flags blowing in the wind, they never break, they only bend.
You know, this was before cell phones. This was before all that. I had no money. And what happened to me on the bicycle trip is something that I'm going to get to in just a little bit. However, I made it back to New Jersey. And then in 2001, I ended up meeting my wife, and she asked, would you like to move back to Montana? And I said, would I? Of course I do. So we ended up moving back out to Montana. Now it's my wife and I, the whole Todd scene's done. You know, my friend Kenzie, he's still living in Montana, just somewhere else. And we're out there with some friends of mine that I still had from the prior, you know, from my prior days out there. And they would all be like, Pat, tell us the story again. Tell us about your time up there with Todd. Tell us about Cajun. And, you know, I would tell them the story, and they became so like enamored and fascinated by the story that one day they were like, look, we all have the weekend off. Let's get in the car and go back up there. And we want you to show us all this crazy stuff you were talking about. And I was like, oh, my God, like I said, it's like driving from New York City to Cleveland. This is a huge ordeal. However, we went, you know, a bunch of us jumped in the car and my wife included. And we drove up to the nearest spot that I could actually find where Todd and Cajun and that could be, because those guys, there were no roads. There were some trails, you know, that you weren't going to find how to get back to where Cajun and Todd's cabin were on a map. It was too far off the grid. But there is one spot in northwestern Montana called the Yak, and it's spelled Y-A-A-K, and it's in the Yak River Valley. And it's an infamous place. There's nothing there. There's a bar there called the Dirty Shame, and there's a mercantile. And we knew this. And I said, look, you guys want to go back up there? Let's go. We're going to go to the Yak. We're going to see if we can find anybody who knew Todd and Cajun, who maybe have come out of the woods. And we went back up there in 2002, it was. And we got there. And long story short, I think we lasted there about 8 hours, because we met my wife, my friends, my friend's girlfriend. we ended up running into some people that knew Todd. We ended up running into people that were from that valley who were so backwoods, so scary to everybody but me. To me, it was like almost a little taste of home, because when I ran into these people, you know, I started talking their language. I started feeding them some memories that I had, and they liked me. They knew exactly who I was talking about. But we are talking about people who are, I don't want to say anything about anybody, but these people were so backwoods, they would scare anybody from regular civilization. And they said to me, you know, I said, look, you know, we might not see anything flying in the sky. Now I'm talking to my friends. We might not see anything flying in the sky right here, but you guys from the backwoods, can you tell my friends about this stuff? You know, because I'm not saying they don't believe me, but, you know, I'm just saying, you know, give them a little info here. And these guys, they went into it. They think they're like, you saw that? Oh, that's nothing. And they started talking about the craft that they see and how much more prevalent it has become. And then they said something to me. The guy said something to me kind of strange. He goes, he's like, have you ever, and he said something about reading, which I didn't think these people could even read a sentence, but he goes, have you ever heard of the book, The Falcon and the Snowman? And I said, yeah, I've heard of it. I said, I have never read the book, but I've seen the movie, and I didn't know where the guy was going with this. And, he says, well, there's a lady that's in the book. Her name is, I believe her name was like Alice White or something. It was something along those lines. They said, she lives in the woods back here. And she sees this stuff all the time. Do you guys want to go meet her? And I was like salivating. I'm like, you know, I'm somebody who looks for these opportunities. I love immersing myself in situations where it might be a little hairy to get out of. But my friends, my wife, my friend's girlfriend, they were scared. They were petrified. They wanted to stay as close to this bar called the Dirty Shame as they could before I finally pulled the plug and we drove 9 hours back and got the hell out of there. But I told them to just hang out. I wanted to go meet this woman, and I wanted to follow them. And we did. We ended up going to meet this woman. She was it was on a trail. It wasn't too far off the main dirt road, and I'm using that loosely because it was a trail. But you had to walk back to this lady's cabin. She was there sitting on her porch. I sat down with her, explained who I was, and not too long after, at treetop level, I don't know if they were F-14s, 15s, or 16s, just come like at treetop level right over this lady's cabin from a base that nobody even knows where it is. Like there is stuff going on in the northwest corner of Montana that is so strange. And, you know, you can go back to Bob Salas at, you know, the one missile silos where the UFOs came and shut down his 10 missiles, you know, in Great Falls, Montana, in the whole state of Montana as a collective. There is just some really, really strange stuff going on up there. And I sat and I talked to this lady about it, you know, and you can only get so far. Eventually it just turns personal, and, you know, you just develop a friendship. And the conspiracy theories, or lack thereof, because you're actually seeing proof of it, are there before your eyes. But what are you going to do? And she had no idea where these planes came from. These guys had no idea where these planes came from. And these guys live in these woods, and they still had no idea. So that was basically what happened to me in Montana in 1996. And from that point forward, my interest in all of this was just catapulted to another level. I was blown away. I came back, and it was something that you never really go too far talking about this to just a random person on the street. If you got to find a certain person who shares your interest in this. And I really left it at that for a while, because, you know, I had no kindred spirits that I could share all of this with. Now, I did write a book about this experience, and I am a published author, but I'm probably the only author out there who tells people not to buy his book. This book, which was actually called The Mountain Mafia, and like, again, I'm stressing again, please don't buy the book, because it's a great, great story, but I wrote it when I was so young, then I become such a better writer now that I rewrote the book, and hopefully one day it'll come back out under a new title. But it's called The Mountain Mafia, and you know, the story is in that book. It's a screenplay that I just took apart and threw into a book real quick. And people loved the story, but the writing was terrible. And, you know, it was written in three different tenses. But the, if you're ever very curious about this story, you know, I'll never make a dime off the book because my publisher, I don't even know what happened to him. But that's the book and that's where the story is. However, this is what leads me down the road. And, you know, so this becomes, I'm back in New Jersey now. And this is where I'll go. When I talked about before, what I talked about before, when I started pedaling from Montana back to New Jersey, there was a very strange story that happened to me along the way. I was about halfway. Now, when I was pedaling, I went across the United States, up into Canada, across Lake Huron, back down into New York. And I was in a lake, in the middle of a lake called Manitoulin Island. And in the middle of Manitoulin Island is a very... It's hard to describe, but the island itself is just a road and trees, and that's it. And when I was on this island, I was so exhausted from pedaling, and there was no place to pitch a tent that I basically had to take my trailer, take my bike, and drag it into the woods and pitch a tent and basically go to sleep. Now, this is a complete different topic from what I was talking about in Montana, but when I was in my tent, on this island, I was sleeping at around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night because I was so tired. And I woke up, I would say probably around 9 or 10 to a very bright moon. And as I said before, there was no trails getting back to where I was. I literally just grabbed all my gear and just dragged it into the woods and just fell asleep. Well, I was in this tent and next to me, I saw something, a silhouette of something just standing next to my tent. I had no idea what it was, but all I knew is that was probably the most scared I've ever been in my life. I was scared in Montana seeing this craft with Todd, no doubt. But what happened along this bike trip 5 years later prompted me to eventually unzip my zipper and stick my head out. And the only thing I saw was just basically two legs. And I know for a fact it wasn't some man. And I screamed louder than I've ever screamed in my life, ran out of the tent, ran to the road, which had nobody on it. Nobody was going to come save me or anything. But I just stayed on the road until dawn, until I finally went back to my tent, to where my tent was. And it was gone. It was just shredded. And I don't know what it was on Manitoulin Island that I saw in 1998 during that bicycle trip. But it was really... you know, I've started to delve into the fact of, you know, some information on the Sasquatch. It was something I never really touched. There were some topics I never really wanted to touch because I was like, you know, crop circles were in there. However, I started to learn about crop circles and I was like, there's something to this. But the Sasquatch situation on Manitoulin Island, and I've done some research, is there's something there. Where there's smoke, there's fire. So basically, during that bike trip, that's the experience that I will never forget. I wish I had more of a foothold or an eye hold on what I saw that night. But all I know is that the legs that were next to my tent were not a moose. They weren't any kind of other four-legged animal that possibly could have been standing next to my tent. Now where my tent was set up was the only spot on the ground where I could possibly pitch a tent. The trees were so thick that you couldn't even get the bike off the road to actually drag it into the trees to set up a tent. So when I ran from it and just sat on the road for the rest of the night, this was something that was completely unnerving. I slept without a tent for like a couple weeks after that. And till finally, you know, my mom sent me some money or whatever, but we are going to jump back to one of the greatest incidents that I've been a part of. And this was one of the main reasons of why I contacted you. In 2014, the Discovery Channel, as actually a subsidiary of the Discovery Channel called Destination America, found an article that I wrote, a very small article about an incident that happened to a friend of mine. What's important about this is this incident that happened to my friend, another very strange experience happened to myself within 100 yards of where this happened to my friend. Now, I'm going to tell you what happened to my friend first, because it's absolutely extraordinary. And I have to preface it with the fact that, you know, my friend at the time was about 50 years old, a very, very respected member of the community, very well off. Somebody, as I said before, would not be telling tales out of school. And as he tells the story, and even before he told the story, we were friends for a good while. And he found out my interest in UFOs. We talked about many different topics, many different days through the time I've known him. But he found out my interest in the UFO topic, and he decided to share this experience with me. And before he even shared the experience, he began tearing up. He began crying. I could see just raw emotion coming out of him. Just he was completely shaken up. And he told me about an incident that happened to his brother and himself when they were fishing. They were fishing in a rather small river. They both had hip waders on. They were wading in the river. And to his right, upstream, he kept hearing this high whizzing sound. And it sounded like zzz, like that. I'm not very good at it, but that's pretty much what it sounded like. And he kept looking to his right, not seeing anything. After a few more minutes, he turned to his right and he said standing in the water right next to him, about 5 feet away, was what he claimed was a 8 foot tall, half mantis, half man, just standing there looking at him. He said the encounter lasted no more than 10 seconds. And I have to reiterate the fact that this is a very hardcore businessman who has ties to every part of the community, who, if he wasn't telling me this story, he's telling nobody this story. You know, not to jump forward, but this story was so traumatizing on him that his brother and him, who were very close, have never spoken again, even to this day. So he says he saw this thing standing right next to him in the river. He says he looked at it, it looked at him, and then with an instant, it just disappeared. Now, we sat there and, you know, surmised on what this possibly could have been, how it disappeared, what was this thing? And as Mark and I really came to grips with, and what I've talked to other people about and people have agreed with me, is that life and life on this planet, especially, and life in the universe is like a radio station. It exists on different frequencies. And, you know, just like we were talking about HARP before, you know, that doesn't tie into this at all. However, you know, when it comes to frequencies, that's the way the world really works. You know, it's really just comes down to the fact that this thing did not want to be seen and it was gone within an instant. And now, as he said on the Discovery Channel, this is what he said on national television, which I have to give him credit for. He fell back into the river after he saw this thing and lost control of himself. Couldn't believe I actually convinced him, and it was under a pseudonym that he got on the program Monsters and Mysteries in America and told his story. But he was not hesitant at all to say how scared he was about this encounter and what it looked like. And after that, when I wrote this article, it's called the Musconetcong River in New Jersey, the river where this took place. And I had to go on and see if anybody along this river, and this is a river I grew up next to. I mean, I lived my whole life next to this river. If anybody else had possibly seen anything like this. And sure enough, one gentleman had a whole webpage devoted to the Mantis Man of the Musconetcong River. And what really solidifies this story for me, it has nothing to do with the Mantis Man. It has nothing to do with him and his brother not speaking anymore. It really comes down to the fact that this is a man who wanted no part of this. If he wasn't talking about this topic, he wanted no part of the UFO community, the cryptozoology community. This was just an incident that happened to completely traumatize him. And this is not something he's able to switch off in his head. He doesn't really just go a few days and not. He thinks about this thing constantly, because I've asked him, I'm like, Mark, I'm like, does this trouble you at all? And it very much troubles him. And, you know, the poor guy, I actually haven't seen him in about a year, but that leads into the incident that happened to me. Now, above the river is an old campground, and the campground is an abandoned campground. Nobody actually uses it anymore. I took my old dog for a walk there around midnight one night, and we were in this abandoned campground. And it was a time when I used to smoke cigarettes, so I decided to duck into the woods and actually have a cigarette sitting on a log. My dog was sitting right next to me. And through the trees, it was very flat terrain. The trees were, you know, it wasn't fall yet. The leaves were still on the trees. And you could basically see through the trees, through this flat terrain, I saw a very bright orange light. And this is an area that I know better than most. And I kept thinking to myself, is this a garage light? What could this possibly be? And I realized there was no houses back there. So I kept looking at this thing, and the orange light started moving from the top of the tree down to the forest floor. And then it would move back up. And then just the pulsating light that actually came off it was very strange. It was an orange that, you know, you have the orange of a basketball. There's different shades of orange. But this orange was just, it was so bright that it really almost hurt the eye to look at. And I sat there and I kept looking at this thing. And it was making these movements that I couldn't get over. And I was starting to get scared. And the story of Mark and the Mantis Man and the river that was 100 yards from me right down below started creeping into my head. And I didn't know what to do. But I tried. It was one of those instances, like one time, you know, there was a time in my life where I kind of got cornered by a bear. And I was like, okay, this is a time in life where you're going to see what you're made of. Like, are you going to be able to take care of this and get out of here? So I sat there, like, trying to just muster up the courage to actually see this thing out. So as the thing kept making very almost, it didn't look like it was under intelligent control. It just looked like it was under something's control. It just had these haphazard movements that kept coming to the top of the tree, down to the forest floor. And that was about it. So as I sat there, the forest just completely went silent. This was not winter. You know, there was some insects, there was some noises that were happening, and all of a sudden it went dead still. And I know that sign. It just, you know, raised the hair on the back of my neck. I was like, oh man. And all of a sudden, every four-legged animal in the woods, raccoons, squirrels, deer, just go blowing by me, just like on both sides of my periphery, just start. I mean, it was like a stampede in the wilderness. I couldn't get over it. I was petrified once again. I mean, I didn't even know what to do. And it took my eyes off the orb. It took my eyes off this light. And I kept looking around on both sides. And by the time I looked back to the front, where this thing was, it was now like within 25 feet of where I was. And at that, I got up and I completely took off. My poor dog, who, you know, she was old at the time, wasn't a great walker as it was. I dragged her through the woods without her legs even, you know, catch up. And I got the hell out of there. And by the time I got back to the campground and looked to where I was sitting, this thing was right on top of the log I was sitting at. And, you know, I thought back, could this possibly have been a man with an orange flashlight? What could this have been? And all I know is that this thing was extremely strange. But the stranger thing was, is that it happened in almost the exact same spot that Mark's encounter with the Mantis Man took place. And I have to say, it's called Stevens State Park in New Jersey on the Musconetcong River. It has some interesting vibes there. And, you know, I've gone back to see if I could see anything, and nothing yet. But that was a very interesting experience I had. In 1989, when my family and I were vacationing down in South Carolina, in a place called Pawleys Island, I was in a house. I was in a vacation house by myself. I was about 14. And my family was out on the beach, my sister, my sister's friend, my mother and my father. And my mother, my sister, and my sister's friend come screaming into the house, the vacation house, and they are crying. They're hysterical. And I kept asking them, I'm like, what's wrong? What's going on? And my mother finally volunteered the information that there was something very strange out hovering over the ocean, and that my father was out there still looking at it. At that, I took off out of the house, ran across the road and onto the beach to see what my dad was looking at. And I kept, as soon as I got to him, I started talking to him. He wanted no part of hearing what I was saying. And I looked out over the water. And there was these three, I don't want to say they looked exactly like the orb that corresponded with the Mantis Man, but these things were darting around just above the ocean surface. And one was red, one was green, and one was blue. And they were all over the place. These weren't things in the sky. These weren't things I was looking up at the sky, into the sky at. These were things that were just above the water. And they were slowly just making their way closer and closer. And apparently, as my dad kind of told me afterwards, they came from the horizon. And if I believe correctly, the horizon anywhere is around 10 or 11 miles away. And he'd been standing there looking at these things for quite a while. My mother, my sister, and my sister's friends were there as well. And when they got to within too close for comfort, that's when the girls ran back into the house. Now, I sat there with my dad and watched these things for, I don't know, it had to be 10 minutes. And until they kept their non-ballistic motion all over the place on top of the water, I would say they were about maybe about 50, between 50 and 100 feet above the water. And at that, they kind of, after a while, just slowly started making their way back out to sea until they were shrouded by some clouds. And it was one of the, I'm actually going back in time. There was one incident that happened before this, when I was about 10 years old. However, this, what happened in South Carolina was something that really left an indelible mark on me for many years. And it really stayed with me. Even when we got out to Montana and the experiences with Cajun and Todd, I remembered what I saw over the ocean down in Pawleys Island in South Carolina. And I wish I could, you know, everybody wishes they could find out what these things were. However, I didn't see any body to them. There was no solidity underneath the light. And it actually reminds me very much of and not to jump topics again. Very much alike from what I saw down in Mexico just a few years ago, what everybody sees down in Mexico. But I'll almost finish with that real quick. But
are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now. The Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
When I was 10 years old, on a country road, this was my very first experience and was pretty much lit the fuse to this interest in this topic that I've had through the years. But my mother and I were driving down a windy country road. You know, it was heavily traveled. It was a road that a lot of people use, but it was still a country two-lane road. It was, you know, shrouded with trees. And we came around a bend at some point, and there were two craft I remember very distinctly. You know, one was a huge white luminescent just ball. And there was a body there. It was metallic. I don't know if it was metallic, but it was solid. And next to it was almost, if you've ever seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where at the end of each time you see the UFOs, they have that little orange ball that just follows it along the way. It was something like that that just kept darting around the other craft. And both sides of the road where we were driving, there was cars backed up behind us that had stopped. And on the other side, there was cars that were coming the other way that had stopped. And in between all these cars that were stopped were just these two things hovering in the road, just above the road. You know, and the thing was, is they were under the trees. So people, if you wanted to say they were a helicopter, you know, helicopters don't come in under the trees. And the only thing I found odd, which I look back years later, was that I do know that when people have encounters like this, machinery shuts down, electricity gets, you know, kind of goes a little haywire, but no cars shut down. You know, the cars were still running. And when the thing started moving, when they started raising up off the ground, just very slowly, everybody at once on both sides of the road started turning around, and nobody went underneath this thing. You know, that was really one of the, I would say, the initial sighting that I had that really sparked it all. You know, I had no clue that through the rest of my life I would be fortunate enough to have these other sightings. Many people only have one, many people only have zero. To get back to what I was saying before, Mexico is just such a hub for this. Through all the research that I've done, you know, this was before I even went to Mexico. I do know that Mexico and a lot of places in South America, there's some wild substantiated stories that come out of there, especially like out of Paraguay and South America, where these guys, these militaries and the governments of like Paraguay per se, They're done keeping the shroud over this. You know, they're starting to release stuff, starting to let the Air Force pilots talk about this. So I was aware of all this, and I knew Mexico was a big hotspot for this. So when I went down in 2016, I stayed with this gentleman, very nice guy, right north of Ensenada on the Pacific Ocean, on the Baja. And he took me for a tour around his house, and he was like, you know, this is where the swimming pool's at, and this is where you're going to be sleeping. And over there, oh, by the way, that's where we see the UFOs every night. As I stated to you prior, he had no idea who he was talking to. I was like, wait, what? From that night, I stayed there for about a week. Every night, you know, I haven't been fortunate enough to have a daytime sighting, which really, I'm not saying it leaves a sour taste in my mouth, but I'd really like to see if what I'm seeing is actually legit in the daytime. You know, nighttime sightings, there's a bit of a shroud of mystery there. However, I got some videotape of these things over the ocean in Mexico every night. You know, I could pretty much equate it to almost like if Venus was right in front of you, like hovering, but the lights of Venus were, it's almost like when you see gasoline in a puddle, how it really has that like murky, different color. You know, it looks like a light coming through a prism. And these things were out every night, like right there. And, you know, all up and down the shoreline, people would come out every night to see these things. It was old hat to them. But I did end up getting some footage of this, which, and it's one of those things where, and, you know, I always say, you know, unless Bigfoot comes and knocks on your door, how are you ever going to know that one of these videos is what it is? You know, you could film UFOs all day, but the old proverbial White House lawn landing or something like that. But I do look at these videos and say, this is quite interesting. And it did prompt me to, after I got back from Mexico, to look into the Stephen Greer CE5 Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind thing about like sitting down and doing some, you know, silent meditate. I guess all meditation is silent, but do some meditation and see if I could, you know, really do something here. Really, if I could summon something and I could see, not whenever I wanted, but see what would happen. And I did one night, and I sat down. I went through the whole rigmarole. As they say, you picture yourself passed out Pluto. And then, you know, actually you picture yourself on the spiral of our galaxy, and then you picture yourself in the solar system, and then you picture yourself on Earth, and you basically bring it all the way down to the point where you're sending out these telepathic messages, to the point where you go all the way to where you're standing or sitting at that very moment. You just bring it down from one to the next, from the spiral of the galaxy to the solar system, to the Earth, to New Jersey, to my town, to where I'm at. And that's how you do it. So I was like, okay, I'll give this a try. Well, I did. And that night I never saw anything. But the very next night, and many, many nights after that, I have seen some great, great stuff. And as I said to you prior, you know, I'm pretty knowledgeable when it comes to planes. I mean, in New Jersey, you're under some flight paths of some pretty big planes, and these are not planes that I'm seeing in the night sky. And the best part is that my wife, who really, God bless her, she, from all my interest in it and stuff that I've told her, she's slowly starting to take an interest in it and really say, I think there's something here. But she would come in at night from being outside, and I would be inside, and she would go, hey, Pat, your friends are outside again. And I would go out, and it all stemmed from the one night that I did this CE5 meditation. And, I find it very interesting. But I, you know, there's a few other things that I wanted to touch on. And, you know, it's really just some of the best stories out there, that really have fascinated me through the years that a lot of people in the public probably don't know about. You know, there was the whole Catalina Island situation when I was out in California a few years ago. You know, a lot of people know about Catalina Island, and, you know, there's some crazy stuff going off there. They've actually filmed huge cables and stuff that lead off the continental shelf to these huge heat signatures under the ocean. I mean, they almost look like if you picture like a football stadium, like a dome, like the Astrodome. Or, you know, where like the Vikings play, it looks like that underneath the ocean where these heat signatures are coming off. And they all kind of rest around Catalina Island, where, you know, Kelly Johnson, who, you know, is the famous aeronautical engineer from the 50s and whatever, he had his sighting. It's just a big hub from where it's at. And I was talking to a guy out in California who lives near Catalina Island. And he's like, he found out I was into the topic. And he goes, I got to tell you a story. He's like, my friend and I were on a secluded beach, and it was not far from Catalina Island. And he's like, we're out there. He's like, we're not doing anything wrong. We're not drinking or so forth. And he's like, we just keep seeing these lights emanating from the ocean. It wasn't one. It wasn't two. It was just lights underneath the water that were out. I don't know. He was saying it was probably between like 50 and 100 yards, more towards 100 yards. And he said you could just see the light like emanating from just below the water. And I was like, all right, you know, that's pretty crazy. And he goes, no. He said, out of nowhere, from out of the woods, he kept stressing the fact that they weren't at a park. They were in the woods in the middle of nowhere. They walked a trail to get there. This wasn't like a beach that people go to. And he said, from out of the woods come three people in scuba gear, and they just walk right by my friend, by this guy and his friend, and just say nothing to them and walk into the water and disappear into the water and start swimming out towards these lights that are in the water near Catalina Island. You know, from there are just a few other instances that I think the public should be very, very well aware of. You know, I don't mean to bring up Dan Aykroyd, but his love of the story of Voronezh is really almost as strong as mine, which is the story from Russia in 1989, where in front of 100 people in a park, this craft landed and these things got out. One of the children ended up disappearing for just maybe like a minute or so. But they had 100 people who all said the same story about the landing of this craft and this robotic entity that got out. And, you know, it's just it's one of these things that I love the story of Voronezh. And also just to touch on, I loved your podcast about the Denver airport. You know, there was a story from the Denver airport that is really one of my favorite stories of all time. I think it was a doctor, who he was in the Denver airport. This is going back from probably right after it was constructed, the new one. And he was looking for a bathroom, and, he couldn't find one. And he finally got an elevator, and he said he went down and down and down, and the doors finally opened to a floor that it looked very strange. It was pristine white. Everything looked like it was sanitized. And he said, lo and behold, he's like, I did find a bathroom. And he goes, but when I walked into the bathroom, I saw a row of urinals all over my head. And it's still, I'm jumping from Voronezh to the Denver airport, but these are topics that are really fascinating for just, you know, somebody who's just getting into the subject to look at and see that there's such a variety of difference here. You know, I mean, there's just, this thing is not just gray aliens abducting people and that's it. This thing has such a spice to, you know, just a bunch of different stuff going on that I really highly recommend it. And the last thing I'll talk about is something that is right by my house in New Jersey, which I can't believe nobody has ever seen. It's really, I only stumbled upon it, and it's on YouTube. And if you YouTube Andover Airport, New Jersey, UFO, it's a little grass landing strip that's about, I'd say about 15 miles from where I'm standing right now. And the YouTube, I think they have about 10 videos up. These people have no views. They maybe get 50 views, 100 views. And it's only 15 miles from where I am. And the stuff that they have filmed is some of the most incredible thing. It's some of the most incredible footage I've ever seen. It's like, it's craft literally right in front of them, morphing into each other. And it's just some incredible footage. The Andover Airport UFO. But Nick, it's an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I'm going to tell you, that's my story.
Really appreciate you coming on today and sharing all these stories for our audience.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Well, guys, that's it for tonight. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, give it a share. Tracks played in tonight's show, written and performed by Patrick McFadden Jr. Go check out his other tracks on SoundCloud. Link is in the description. And we will be back next Friday. Have a great weekend, guys.
There's a place in Warren County you gotta see, out amongst the cornfields, where everyone is free. place you might have heard of. Legend always grows. A lot of people died there, called the Shades of Death Row. Rolled a rock across the road. See some lights begin to slow. Grab my guns, I locked and loaded. Killed a man on Shades of Death Row. Story as it goes, daddy watched his daughter walk off a cliff. As the Indians attacked, and they finally did a man. Further up the mountain, down the road with all the bums. Special stretch of forest, they call it Jenny Jones.
Sent to kill me, I've been told.
You're the only man I know won't fight for gold, and that's why you're my best friend. We've been brothers all along to the end, and our paths crossed once before. It was many years ago before this war, and I gave you your name. It's what I've come so many miles to explain. You're the sun I never got to hold, and your name is Leopold. And at least before you killed me, you were told. Now I die at your side, and behold my only son as he cries. Your mother still waits for you. Please tell her that you killed me when this is through. She dreamed this most every night, and you can go and tell her that she was right. We both sat on her horse late at night. She always said it'd be you. Who would run me through and take my life? On a day I met my son and lost my wife. Tell you your name. Your name is Leopold. Leopold. And now, my son, take this land. Tell your mother I succeeded in my plan. I met my only son, and I gave to him my land and all my guns. You are Leopold. Leopold. You're my son, and now I die.